Tereo Ererangi o Te Mania. This episode was produced in Otatahi by Plains Media, with support from New Zealand On Air.
Kia ora and hello, 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 my fabulous friends. Welcome to the all-new, totally exciting season of Chloe Dilly Seeking Talents. I am your host, Chloe Dilly, and I'm back older, wiser, and more thrilled than ever to showcase the most amazing talents and inspiring stories from all around. This season is going to be an absolute blast. We're talking epic talents, heartwarming journeys, and maybe a few surprises along the way. Whether you're here to be inspired, entertained, or just have some fun, you're in the right place. So, grab your headphones, turn up the volume, and get ready to smile, laugh, and maybe even dance a little. Because this is Chloe Dilly Seeking Talents. Let's make some magic together. Kia ora koutou, and welcome to an episode of Chloe Dilly Seeking Talents unlike any we've had before. I want to say, before we begin, that today's conversation is a genuinely serious one. My guest today is a 21-year-old New Zealander currently serving as a volunteer soldier in Ukraine, and for his safety and the safety of people around him, he goes only by his call sign, Kiwi, and we will not be using his real name, his exact unit, or his exact location today, and I would ask all of you listening to respect that as well. Before this, Kiwi was a student at one of New Zealand's top colleges. At just 19 years old, he founded and ran a successful company. He had, by any measure, an extraordinary future already unfolding in front of him. And then he made a decision that very few people in this country or anywhere would ever make. He left it all behind to volunteer to fight for Ukraine. Today, Kiwi joins us from Ukraine via Zoom to talk about what that decision has meant, what life at the front line actually looks like, what modern warfare looks like at the age of the drone, and what daily life for the ordinary people of Ukraine right now. Kiwi, thank you so much for making the time for this. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Kiwi, let's start with you before all of this. You were a teenager in Wellington when Russia's full-scale invasion began in February 2022. What do you remember about seeing that on the news for the very first time?
The main thing that stuck out to me was that, you know, it was absolutely crazy that in, you know, this day and age, right, in the 21st century, you know, invasions like that could still happen. You know, a big country trying to invade and subjugate a smaller one. And, you know, reading on the news, I remember it was the afternoon in New Zealand when it happened, early morning in Ukraine, and, you know, hearing about the waves of missiles that were raining down. It was, you know, a very weird feeling, and of course it brought a lot of unease when things like that, you know, happen. You know, you sort of start to wonder how perhaps it might start affecting you closer to home. You know, even though I was in New Zealand at the time, some of these things, of course, in terms of geopolitics, can have a bit of a cascading effect. So it was worrying, of course, and, you know, had a lot of, you know, sympathy and worry for the people of Ukraine at the time.
What was it that took you from watching the war unfold on the news as a teenager to actually deciding you want to go fight in it yourself?
So I was aware of the International Legion that has existed in Ukraine since 2022. So essentially the Ukrainian government and President Zelensky put out a request for, you know, international volunteers, you know, former army and military veterans to come to Ukraine and fight alongside the Ukrainian military and specialised foreigner units. And that was in 2022. Now, of course, at the time, they, you know, wanted people of prior combat experience, right, so they could get straight into the fight. The situation was still quite desperate. And then, you know, of course, a couple of years happened. Ukraine had some success with some counter-offensives holding the defensive line in Donbas. And the, of course, started to expand the, you know, list of people who could come and fight alongside Ukrainians. So then it got to a point where they said, from anyone from anywhere in the world, so long as you're willing to be trained and come and fight alongside us, then you can come along, we'll train you, we'll give you everything you need. And when I found out that, you know, they had waived most of the requirements and all that you needed to do was show up and, you know, have a willingness to fight, as soon as I heard that, I decided, you know, I couldn't just sit by on the sidelines and not do anything, right?
Did you have any prior military education, training, or practical experience before you became a volunteer, or was this something you learned essentially from scratch?
Yeah, so unless we count Fortnite and Call of Duty, I would say not a whole lot of prior military experience, no. And of course, you know, the main thing that I knew coming into Ukraine was to expect the unexpected. Of course, it's one thing to be joining, you know, an army, say, perhaps the New Zealand Defence Force in peacetime. You know, the army can be, you know, an interesting place and you learn a lot quite quickly. But to do that and to be joining an army that is actively fighting, you know, against one of the largest militaries in the world, you know, a defensive war, an all-out war, essentially, it's a very different ballgame. So I came in not having any practical prior military experience, but, you know, knowing to expect the unexpected, really.
Walk us through the actual process. How does a 21-year-old New Zealander legally and practically go from Wellington to the front line in Ukraine? What did enlisting actually involve?
So it was a former colleague of mine that informed me that the Ukrainian military, in terms of recruiting foreigners, was now taking, you know, people with no prior military experience and starting to train them up. So as soon as I heard that, I decided to start making sort of preparation. So there are a lot of, you know, sort of connections with other foreigners that are already fighting here that you can chat with and make. So I decided to do some research about which particular military unit I wanted to join, you know, what sort of role I would want to get into. And after doing the research, I messaged a recruiter from the particular unit, chatted with them for a while, got my tickets, got an invitation letter to Ukraine, and then got on the plane and headed over here. And then once I arrived in Ukraine, then began the formal enlistment process and then all of that.
What kind of preparation did you do before you left? Did you have to buy your own uniform and protective gear, or were you equipped by the Ukrainian military or another organization?
So the Ukrainian military, they do equip you, of course. They give you, you know, all the basic sort of equipment you need, you know, in terms of a helmet, plate carrier, rifle, of course, all of that. But also, we do have the option to procure and use our own gear. So what I did in particular was, on my way to Ukraine, I stopped in the United States to see some friends of mine. And, of course, you know, the Americans, they're well known for their love of military equipment. So what I did there was I purchased a few different things, such as my own plate carrier and helmet and things like that. Some sort of more protective gear as well, just so that I would know that the gear I had was, you know, a real proper fit for me, you know. And of course, it gives you the opportunity to sort of customize what sort of loadout you take with you, of course, as well. Adaptability is quite important in the front line at the moment. So that was a, you know, the decision I made. But the Ukrainian military, if you show up here with nothing, of course, they're not going to send you out with nothing. They equip you, they train you, they give you everything you need. And the equipment that they issue is quite good, but also I'm happy with what I have as well.
Volunteering like this means leaving behind a regular income. How have you managed to cover your day-to-day needs since arriving? Does Ukraine provide any kind of financial support to international volunteers?
Yes, so they do pay us to be here. Of course, this is certainly the sort of job you don't do for money. I do always have to laugh a little at the online trolls that say, well, you're only there because you want to, you know, fight for money and things. And I won't get into specifics, but I did make a lot more in a nice, comfortable office job in New Zealand than I have made here so far. But, of course, like I said, it's not about the money. And they do pay a salary. So how it's split up is you get a base pay, which recently they've actually given quite a significant increase in pay to frontline soldiers. So the base pay is about 30,000 hryvnia a month, which off the top of my head is about 800 to 1,000 New Zealand dollars. And then you get a combat bonus depending how many days in a month you spend at the frontline. So that can vary at the moment since I've increased it. I'm actually not sure how much it is, but the number I heard was up to 11,000 US dollars a month for frontline assault troops. It used to be a fair bit lower. But of course, the Ukrainian government has implemented some reforms. They want to you know, increase the standard of living for these frontline assault troops. So, yeah, they do pay you. Of course, we get paid the exact same as the Ukrainians we serve alongside. So it's, you know, of course, before they implemented this reform, things did get a little bit tight in terms of funding because a lot of the equipment that we purchase, we do have to fundraise for ourselves. So, like, there'd be in a situation where, you know, maybe I get a salary of, you know, maybe 100,000 hryvnia or so, And half of that would have to go towards maintaining things we already have, you know, like Starlink, purchasing, you know, new generators, equipment such as that. So, you know, a lot of the money you do get, it goes back into supporting the unit and the fight that you're with. But also, you know, while I was at the front, don't have to pay for your own housing or food. So you do get to save a little bit up.
Beyond pay, what other support is available to foreign volunteers? Things like housing, medical care, or equipment resupply?
So when you're, you know, in the army, of course, fighting, it really depends on the situation you're in. A lot of times you do have to procure things like your own housing and whatnot. You know, have to find a nice little shack and wherever you're based and base your team out of it. You have to pay for that. Medical care, of course, you do get, you know, that provided for you in the military. So yes, there is some level of support, but also a lot of it is a very, what I say, sort of self-funded mission. But also in a way that gives you a lot more flexibility, of course, to run, you know, a team how you wish. But yeah, so it's sort of a 50-50.
Are you the only New Zealander serving in your unit or the forces you work alongside? Where do the other international volunteers around you tend to come from?
Yes, so in my particular unit, I was a bit of an edge case. I happened to be the only foreigner serving in a unit of all Ukrainians, which is a very interesting experience. When I showed up, you know, I didn't know what to expect, but I had a rough idea of that I would probably be alongside other foreigners, which turned out to not be the case. But also serving with Ukrainians, it was, you know, quite nice. Learned a lot. So there are quite a few Kiwis here. I won't say how many, but it's, you know, more than you might expect. Actually, there is a joke I heard from former Defence Minister Ron Mark, who said it was a Ukrainian that told him that we have to stop using the call sign Kiwi because every New Zealander that comes here wants to be called Kiwi. You can't have dozens of Kiwis, of course. But in terms of other than us, the main foreign volunteers, they come from the United States, Britain, Australia as well, all over Europe, really. I mean, I've met guys from, you know, Switzerland, from Sweden, from Spain. But also we have quite a few foreign volunteers that come from places like Colombia and Brazil. So from South America as well, you know, guys that come a very long way from their home to fight alongside us.
Have you had the chance to meet President Zelensky or come close to that level of war effort at any point?
In Ukraine, no, I have not yet met President Zelensky. It would be a great honour to. He's, I'd consider him at this point, you know, essentially a leader of the free world, right? You know, maybe I don't agree with him on everything, but that's, you know, not only politics, that's life. You're never going to agree with everything, with everyone on everything. But how he's, you know, managed the war so far, how he's run things, right? I don't think there could have been a better man at a better time to run, you know, the war effort how he has. So, well, unfortunately, I haven't met him. Maybe one day, fingers crossed. I do think he's a pretty great guy.
Let's talk about exactly what you do. You operate drones. Can you explain, as much as you are able to, without compromising security, what your actual day-to-day duty looks like?
Yep. So actually, beyond drones, I'm also an infantryman, both on assault and defensive operations. So first off, I guess the day-to-day sort of depends in terms of frontline work, I assume you're talking about. Yep. So at the front line, essentially, I'll say for a drone mission, since that's what you asked about. There are many different types of drones, actually, of course, but I'll use my favourite one, the Vampire, which is a heavy bomber drone. But in addition to bombs, it can also deliver supplies and logistics to other frontline troops. So day to day, we'll be in a little underground shelter on the front line or near it, called a blindage. We'll have in there supplies, you know, a generator just outside, you know, we'll have a Starlink and a power bank to charge all the batteries to the drone. We'll have all the batteries charged up, make sure everything is good to go. Then we'll go set up the antenna for the drone, get that all up there, make sure the Starlink's running smoothly, have the generator running. And then we'll take the drone out of a little hole where it's buried in, take him, you know, outside where he can fly, I guess, put in the batteries, put in either the bombs if we're going to bomb Russian positions, or we'll put in the supplies if we're going to drop them on, you know, neighbouring friendly Ukrainian units. And then we take off and we fly. And for a Vampire drone, you have a shift of maybe up to 12 hours and then 12 hours rest afterwards because you've got to recharge the batteries. So 12 hours of flying, 12 hours of rest. Of course, sometimes things differ. Sometimes you might have an easier day than others. Sometimes it's a lot harder where you have to be going flat out, trying to get logistics or bombs to wherever they need to go. So in terms of a drone mission, it is a pretty set-in-stone sort of thing as compared to, you know, infantry, whereas, you know, anything can happen there. With a drone, it's a certainly more of a, I won't say conventional job by any means, but there is a very sort of set schedule most of the time. So
drones have completely changed what modern warfare looks like. Can you explain to listeners who have never thought about this before just how central drones have become to this war?
Yep, so I would say the drone is just as, if not more, you know, more of a power factor in war than even the invention of something like the tank, right? You know, it's as important as the invention of, you know, a rifle or a machine gun. How it affects war really can't be overstated. You know, even within the span of 4 years, right? I always say that technology in Ukraine then evolves so fast that something 6 months ago might not be relevant today. And that's especially true of drones. The first use of FPV drones in Ukraine was during the ATO, the anti-terrorist operation against the Russian soldiers that first invaded in 2014. There were small volunteer units that were using them for reconnaissance and to strike Russian positions then. But the main, biggest drone effect on this war are FPV strike drones, the drones that have explosives attached to them and they fly into, you know, tanks or enemy infantry or into enemy artillery, things like that. Those are the big, you know, power players in this war. And to be honest, you know, the people that I talked to, I wasn't here in, you know, 2022, 2023, but the way drones have affected the war is completely different. So the ability to move with tanks and with mechanized forces has essentially been completely removed, right? So whereas early in the war, you know, you might have an infantry assault alongside a mechanized, you know, maybe an M113 or a BMP, an armored personnel carrier, now the infantry has to use essentially small unit tactics to infiltrate past each other on the front line. And what that means, of course, is that, you know, with so many drones in the air, both sides have a very clear picture of what the front line looks like. And it's a, in many areas of the front, it's a case of if you go outside and you get seen, you die. Especially in, you know, Ukraine's wide open fields, right? In a, you know, an urban environment in the cities, it is a lot different. But also the drone threat there remains very omnipresent as well. So you really can't overstate how big of an impact drones have on this war. It has taken it from an area of, you know, maneuver warfare where tanks and infantry are constantly moving to fight to a very almost World War I style series of trench warfare, because you can't really leave your position without being a target of fire.
There are different types of drones being used for very different purposes. Surveillance, strikes, logistics. Can you break down some of those categories for us and explain why each matter?
Yeah, of course. So like I was saying before, one of the my favourite platforms personally, it's called a Vampire drone. It's a hexacopter, so it's got six blades on it. And we can use that one either for logistics to our friendly infantry, or we can use it as a bomber platform to strike Russian positions. So that one is a very big drone. It can carry up to 20 kilometres worth of supplies. 20 kilograms worth of supplies, and of course, that's a more of an older style of drone. The newer ones, they are very good in what they do. They can carry a whole lot more, a whole lot further. I won't go into specific details. And then we also have reconnaissance drones, things like Mavics and Matrices, things like that. They can surveil a very wide area of the front line in a very short space of time. Gives us an ability to look at the battlefield, essentially unparalleled in the history of warfare beforehand. And of course, we also have FPV strike drones, the ones I mentioned earlier that directly hit enemy infantry or armor or artillery. And those ones are really the big game changer as well. Because whereas before in warfare, you know, you might, if you wanted fire support, you would have to wait to call in maybe an artillery or a bombing strike. These drones, you know, they can be there in a matter of minutes. And of course, they are a very omnipresent threat. Any infantryman or any soldier really in Ukraine will tell you that one of their biggest fears might not necessarily be gunfire or artillery. It's, you know, maneuvering through a field and hearing a faint whine or buzz in the air where you know there is potentially an enemy drone that has spotted you.
How has drone technology and tactics changed even since you have arrived? Is this a part of the war that is evolving week to week?
Oh, absolutely. It's a... you know, like I said, you might have something that was relevant 6 months ago, that might not be now. There, you know, the way that drones work, I'll give you an example for last year in the Donbass area. I can probably talk about this a little bit. For example, during the battle for Pokrovsk and Mihailovgrad, one of the big issues that we started to deal with was Russian fiber optic drones. So normal FPV drones, right, they're controlled by a radio link, radio wave, whereas fiber optic drones, they use like a fiber cable, you know, like the one that perhaps sends internet directly into your house. And these trail a fiber cable behind the drone. Now, the problem with these ones is we can't jam them with our electronic warfare equipment. And of course, that creates a bit of a problem because one of the few counters we have to these FPV strike drones is electronic warfare. So how do you jam an unjammable drone? Oh, at that point, you have to use cover and you have to use a rifle or a shotgun. And thirdly, I always say praying helps a little bit too. If not, if only to comfort yourself a little bit. So those FPV strike drones, right, the fiber ones, they weren't an issue 3 months before. Well, our main major issue 3 months before the battle for Pokrovsk. So that was actually a Ukrainian innovation that the Russians looked at and started using en masse in that sector. Then also, you might think that these fiber optic drones are quite good, right? They would now be everywhere. Well, it turns out that that technology does have some limitation. So while they were everywhere in Pokrovsk, all along the front line now, you will start to see a 50-50 use where half might be fiber and half might be radio because each technology has its limitations. So that's one thing I've seen a couple of times here where a new technology will come and some people will say, oh, this will completely change how the war is being fought. And then a couple of months go by, we see how the technology is practically used, the downsides, the disadvantages, and then it'll be like, well, it's a, you know, it's got some edge cases, but it's not going to completely change things, right? So month to month, even week to week, things can completely change.
We have all seen footage now of long-range strikes into the enemy's territory using drones. How significant of a shift has that been in how this war is actually being fought?
Yes, so it's been a quite a significant shift, especially in the deliverance of what us Ukrainians call kinetic sanctions against the Russian oil industry. Now, I'm sure perhaps you saw a few days ago that footage of Moscow burning because the oil refineries there were struck. Now, if you told someone 4 years ago, just as the full-scale invasion was beginning, that Moscow would be burning because of Ukrainian strikes, they probably would have laughed. Well, now, we're going to see who's laughing now, right? I mean, Ukraine has been able to deliver these strikes thousands of kilometres from our territory into side Russia. And, you know, it's a great technology for that, right? Because if you're going to be an imperialist warmonger, it's perhaps not a best idea to do so when your main economy export is a highly flammable liquid that can only be stored in giant tanks. So I'm sure most people might have seen that photo of that oil storage drum in Moscow exploding and the lid being flung off into the air. And I'm sure we'll see many more photos and images like that very soon. But these deep strike drones, right, we also saw last year with Operation Spiderweb, the Ukrainian, you know, mission against the Russian strategic bomber fleet, where we essentially wiped out one third of their strategic nuclear bombers. Now, it's like strikes with that, with these drones, you know, that are very, very, you know, very important for the war effort, right? Because the more that we can degrade Russia's economy with them, you know, think of it like the Allied bombing campaign against, you know, German war industry during the Second World War, right? The more we can degrade their war industry, the faster we can win this war and all go home.
What does it feel like, psychologically, to fight a war partially through a screen, watching a drone feed, while also being physically present in a genuinely dangerous place?
Yeah, so it is, you know, of course, a very, I almost say it's like two different wars, kind of, when you're fighting on a drone position versus, you know, an infantry position, right? But, you know, through a drone screen, I mean, it gets to a point where you can see the almost the worst of what the Russians have to offer. And, of course, when you know what atrocities they've committed in Ukraine, it's hard to feel very bad for them. And, of course, we do give them an opportunity to surrender, of course, but, you know, many of them do not take it. So when you're fighting a combatant that has come to invade your territory, the land of, you know, your friends and colleagues, you know, doesn't affect you too much seeing the enemy then get blown up by a drone. Whereas infantry combat, well, that is very different. It is a, you know, can be very face-to-face, right, can be very intense. It's a different style of warfare entirely. So I would say, if anything, the infantry is more affecting. You'll probably get the same answer from many people here.
For people who have only ever seen drones used for photography or recreation, what do you wish more people understood about what this technology has become capable of?
Yeah, so they drones are a very versatile platform. And the interesting thing we've seen with Ukraine is that there's a lot of technological development going into them. So now you've got drones that can travel very, very far distances with very big payloads, whereas earlier in the war, you know, it was smaller drones, smaller payloads, right? So every month, basically, I'll see a new drone being tested with a new number for the range and a new number on the payload. And I think it's crazy how quickly the technology is evolving, right? But of course, you know, the more innovation, the better, right? We'll always be happy about that. But I think after the war as well, you'll probably see a lot of this military style technology be implemented into civilian drone space. And it'll be interesting to see what can be done there.
I want to ask you about something that moved a huge number of people around the world. Footage was released by Ukraine's 3rd Army Corps showing an elderly woman named Antonia Horozha being guided and helped to safety from a wrecked frontline village using a ground robot with the words, "Grandma, sit down," on the side of it. Were you connected to that operation in any way, or can you tell us what you know about it and what it represents?
So I was not connected to that particular mission, but I do have a colleague who is in that brigade. But for that mission specifically, that's really the main difference, I think, between the Russian army and the Ukrainian army, right? The Russian army go on, you know, human safaris where they will hunt civilians with FPV drones. Whereas the Ukrainian army, right, we, you know, do our best in every sector that we're in to, you know, try help save and evacuate any civilian population that is still there. So while I wasn't with that particular operation, I do have one that I do remember where a grandma in a frontline village knew that there is, you know, a military operation nearby, both the Russian and Ukrainian soldiers. And it was winter at the time, right? So there was snow. So she wrote in the snow, "Hleb, bread, please." And we saw that with a reconnaissance drone. So what we did is we loaded up a Vampire drone with some supplies that normally we would also be sending to the frontline troops. We put some bread and a couple of other things in there, and we dropped these supplies directly on her house. The next day, a reconnaissance drone of ours was flying over, and she had written, "Dyakyu, thank you," in the snow. And that was, you know, I think of that sometimes. It's a very, you know, heartwarming story, right? Even on war, you know, in the front lines of war, you know, we still do our best. We don't lose our humanity, right?
Stories like that show a side of this technology that is about saving lives, not just fighting. How often does that side of war, the rescue and evacuation side, come up in your own experience?
Yeah, of course. I mean, with war, right, it's more relevant on infantry positions. Drone positions, of course, while they're certainly not completely safe, it's not as, I guess you would say, dangerous as a frontline infantry position, right? So, of course, it'll, you know, you have to deal with injuries and, you know, we call them status 300s. You know, that does happen a fair bit. But, of course, we have a, you know, great team of, you know, guys who fight alongside us, great team of medics, of course. And actually one thing that is starting to be used more is ground drones, right? I'm sure you've seen the, you know, tracked and wheeled drones that go along the ground. And one thing they're useful for is medical evacuations from the front line. For example, there was one that I saw where we had a guy that was injured on position. They sent a armored ground drone to come rescue him direct to our trench. And we loaded our injured guy into the robot, closed up around him, and it drove off. The ground drone, it was about 20 or 30 kilometers that went with this guy inside. In the span of 3 hours, he got back to a rear village. Our medics back there, they unloaded him, treated him. And yeah, and if we didn't have a technology like that, it is possible that guy, you know, possibly could have died. But because of the ground technology, the drone technology that we had, it saved his life. And, you know, now he's with his family, right? So I have seen firsthand how that technology can sort of, you know, shape war.
Can you describe, as honestly as you are comfortable doing, what daily life actually looks like for you at or near the front line?
Yeah, so on an infantry position, like I said, a bit different from a drone one. You never really know what to expect, right? I mean, this war is about expecting the unexpected. You know, that you might come under fire from, you know, FPV strike drones from the enemy, their artillery, their multiple rocket launch systems, you know, even airstrikes. So a big thing that they use at the moment is glide bombs, right? So their aircraft can't enter Ukrainian airspace because of our air defense. So what they'll do is they will throw essentially a glide bomb with little wings attached, which can glide, you know, maybe 50 or 60 kilometers and then hit our trench, even if they fired it from way behind the front line. So those are a big worry to, you know, as well. And of course, it also depends on the mission, you know, whether you're on defense or whether you're planning an assault. Of course, you have to deal with the enemy infantry as well, not only while you're on the front line, but also getting to and from that position, right? There's a lot of enemy sabotage and reconnaissance groups, DRGs, that you have to contend with. So, yeah, it's an ever-changing sort of environment. It's certainly not your average office job, I can say that much.
Have you been shot at, hit, or hurt during your time there? You do not need to go into more detail than you are comfortable with.
Yes. Yep. Turns out when you shoot at the enemy, they do like to shoot back. But I always say the main thing is, regardless of what has happened or what will happen, still alive, still here, that I am grateful for every day.
Where do you and the people around you go during an actual attack? What does taking shelter look like in practice?
So, of course, it depends where you are. When I'm, you know, in a city like Kiev, I'm at the point where my attitude most of the time is what happens, happens. Perhaps not the best attitude to have, but I always joke that there's no way I've survived a year and a half on the front line only to be taken out in a drone in the middle of the capital. But, of course, you know, when you're on the front line, right, you hear about incoming strike drones or cabs. We have like I was talking about, a little blindage. I always call them a little hobbit hole, right? It's buried a little bit deep underground. You retreat there and pray. That's what you do. But, so, of course, different responses depending on where you are, right?
Can you share one or two of the moments that genuinely frightened you the most since you arrived?
Oh, there's more than one or two, but I suppose one of the main ones that sticks out was during one of my first combat missions in Donbass. And I did know, you know, about these FPV drones, but I was yet to encounter them. And during a infiltration to an infantry position, heard a faint buzzing in the air, and I figured, oh my God, you know, you never really know, you know, how to react fully. I mean, you have your training, right? But then it's also a sort of instinct thing. So as soon as you hear that buzzing, you and your squad mates essentially have to sprint for whatever cover you can find. And then, you know, you're sitting there as you hear this drone circling, trying to hunt and find you, right? And it's a bit comforting when you do hear it finally explode, as long as it's away from you, of course. You know, you hear that bang when it's run out of battery or something like that, and then you can keep moving. For me, the biggest fear hasn't been getting shot at or artilleryed or bombed. It has been these FPV strike drones, because you know that they are personally hunting you. There is someone on the other end that is looking for you and he's trying to find you. So it's like it activates almost like a primal instinct, that, you know, fear and feeling of being hunted, right? So dealing with those is probably the biggest one. Of course, you get used to it. It's been, you know, over a year now, and you know, it's at the point where, you know, you hear them. And, of course, it's a little bit, you know, makes your heart pound a bit. But, you know, you go through the motions, you know what to try and do.
How do you and the soldiers around you process fear in the moment? Is there a way you have learned to function despite it?
Yeah, I mean, you just deal with it, right? It is part of the job. You do function despite it, because you always have a job to do, right? And what always helps me is that if something's, you know, particularly like, what I do think of is that there are many Ukrainian children here, right, that don't have, you know, they have to deal with it every single day. They don't have a choice. And they certainly didn't sign up for it, you know, at least in the army, right? I sort of knew what I was getting into. But there are, you know, innocent children, civilians, you know, on the frontline regions that have to deal with this Russian terror every day, such as human safaris where Russian soldiers and drone pilots will go out of their way for target practice. They will hunt civilians. And in the Kherson region, it's been hundreds of civilians that have been targeted and hit since 2022, since we liberated the city from Russian occupation. And they do this in other areas too, like Nikopol, even in Kharkiv and Sumy regions. It's, you know, unbelievable the level of terror and atrocity that they try to commit on innocent civilians, right? So, you know, I think of the civilians that we're fighting to protect, you know, things further, and I need an extra boost of motivation, right?
What about after a frightening moment passes? How do you and the people around you decompress, even briefly, in an environment like that?
I mean, you know, it's sort of like when one thing happens and passes, you know, the next one won't be far behind it. So when you're on the front line, at least, it's not a whole lot of decompressing to be done. It's like, oh, at least that particular one is over, and then you're sort of waiting for the next, you know, threat or thing to show up, right? But, you know, when you're serving with people who, you know, you get on with, your brothers in arms, really, it knowing you've got each other there makes the whole thing a bit easier.
What do you do with your time when you are not actively on the front line?
So it's quite good. You get a little bit of freedom to, you know, go and do what you want. So me and my brothers in arms, what we would do is we'd get off the front line. First thing we would do after driving, you know, back from the exfiltration point is we'd always stop, get a hot dog and some coffees on the way back to our safe house. And then normally how the system works is that maybe you'll have a 2-week rotation on, 2-week off, or maybe 1 week on, 1 week off. That's supposed to be the rule. Of course, there are many exceptions. But, you know, if you've got a week off, you know, what we'll do is we'll go into town, go to the restaurant a few times, get some burgers, something other than frontline rations. We do love our banyas in Ukraine, like little spas. So we'll go there, unwind, relax, you know, things like that. Gives you a chance to live at least as normal of a life as you can, right? So, yeah, you do get a bit of opportunity to unwind when you're not on the front.
You have now spent real time in Ukraine. What is your sense of how the country and the war have changed compared to 2 years ago?
So compared to, you know, when I first showed up, right, a lot of it is, well, in terms of changing in terms of like civilian society, right, there haven't been a whole lot. But what I have noticed is that Ukrainian civil society, even during the wartime, is very engaged, right? We still have a lot of participation, you know, in government, right? So even during the period of martial law, it's not as though people are unheard. For example, last year we had some protests against one particular law that was being passed, and it was because of those protests that they decided not to pass it. So it's, you know, it's still a very civilly active, you know, society, right? And that always makes me happy to see that, you know, both on and off the front line, Ukrainians have a very strong sense and desire for democracy, right? It was because of that we broke away from Russian rule in 2014. So, you know, things haven't majorly changed in the span of 2 years in terms of that. But, yeah, you know, it's been interesting living among it and seeing just how, you know, civilian society in Ukraine is.
Is the war something that touches the entire country, or is daily life largely unaffected in many areas, with the fighting mostly in specific regions?
Oh, so it is something that affects the whole country, but in different ways. So here in Kyiv, every night, essentially, we do have air raids. It reminds me of the London Blitz somewhat. You know, we deal with air raids and airstrikes every night, not only in Kyiv, but in other cities, even ones that are quite far west. Though the further west you go towards Europe, the less likelihood of these airstrikes there are. In Lviv and Uzhhorod, places like that, there's a much smaller risk than maybe you in Kyiv. And the further east you go, of course, or further south, the threat does increase significantly. Some places like Kharkiv and Sumy, the threat there and is, you know, there's a lot of glide bomb strikes because the cities are so close to the front line, you have daily strikes, right? And in cities still in Donbass, like Kramatorsk and Slovyansk, you have FPV strikes, these human safaris as well. So it really depends where you are. The further east you go, there's more of a threat. But the war does affect pretty much every area of Ukraine, of Ukrainian society, right? You know, we'll have apps on our phones telling us when an airstrike might be happening nearby, you know, when you're in the city, right? But what I have also noticed is that despite this threat, Ukrainians, you know, keep living. They keep living their lives, still go to work, still try exist as much as possible despite the war. Very resilient people, I've noticed.
When you are not on the front line and you interact with ordinary local people, what do you see? What does life look like for them right now?
So it does depend, you know, where exactly you are. So in Kiev versus a little frontline village, it can be a bit different. In a little frontline village, it's a very interesting, or at least near the frontline, you know, where we have a safe house, maybe could be 20, 30 kilometers away from the front. People keep living their lives. But what I noticed especially was people were very curious why a New Zealand fella had showed up in their village to, sort of fight alongside them. But it was great, though, you know, because you'd have people like there'd be a lady at the local store or a guy at a restaurant, and they would get to know me, and, you know, I'd be like, oh, Kiwi, hello, you know, whenever they would see me again, you know, after coming back maybe from a combat mission or something like that. So there was a, you know, sense of being integrated with the community, even if perhaps I didn't fully know the language or the culture at that stage. It was nice to, be recognized, sort of. It was quite a nice feeling.
In a lot of frontline and heavily affected communities, it is mostly women, children and elderly people who remain, while many men are fighting. Has that been your experience, and what is that like to witness?
Yeah, so there are quite a few people that, you know, obviously don't want to particularly leave their homes. Luckily, in the sectors of the frontline I've been in, there have been, not a whole lot of women and children, but there are quite a few elderly people that either don't want to or can't evacuate from their homes and dwellings. And of course, we try to keep the fighting away from wherever they are. We try to evacuate them where we can. But it is women and children also that are genuinely most affected in cities such as, Kharkiv or frontline ones, sort of like Sumy or even Kherson. They are also targeted, you know, by Russian strikes, Russian glide bombs, that sort of thing, which is very unfortunate because, you know, no one should have to, you know, deal with these sort of consequences of war, much less civilians, much less children, right? So it's it is something that unfortunately affects everyone.
What about children and local schools? Are schools still operating in the areas you've spent time in? And what is that experience like for the kids who live there?
Yeah, so not directly on the front lines, of course, but, you know, maybe 20 or even 30 kilometres away from them. Yes, there are, you know, kids that still go to school, people still trying to live their lives, even that close to the front line of such a major war, which I always find, you know, resilience is very interesting and amazing and, well, inspiring, really. But actually, I, you know, on a couple of occasions, we receive letters from the army from these kids. You know, they write things such as thank you for the protection, that sort of thing. It's I would always carry one with me whenever I would go to the front line, you know, as a nice little, like a I'd look at it whenever I needed just a little extra boost of motivation. So yeah, there are, you know, you see kids running around in little village frontline, well, not exactly frontline, but sort of behind the line villages like that. And some of them would even come to recognize me, you know, they'd see me walking in town and they'd say, Kiwi, oh, hello. Brought a pizza for a couple of different occasions. It's nice to do little things like that for them, right? And one thing they are very interested in is sort of chevron patch trading. There's a couple of these kids that like to collect, you know, patches from various units, right? So they'll offer to trade them with you. So that's also a nice little, you know, thing. They are very, active and engaged, right? So, yeah, it's interesting seeing that.
Do you speak any Ukrainian? How has language been for you, both practically and in terms of connecting with the people around you?
Ну так, зараз говорю ще тільки трохи українську мову. Це дуже складну мову, але я хочу вчити більше. So I still only speak a little bit of Ukrainian, but I am trying to learn and study a bit more. I wouldn't say I'm fluent by any means, but I certainly have enough to, work in frontline situations, of course, and also do simple things when I'm away from the front, you know, go to restaurants, go to a supermarket, know what I'm looking for or asking for. And of course, on the front line, I know how to, you know, say, oh, you know, contact Vipered, you know, tank Trelis Dimitrov or something like that, for example. Things like that. Yeah, I would say I'm not exactly fluent, but I'm pretty comfortable with where I'm at, and I do want to study a bit more, you know, so I can continue to live here.
What are some similarities and some real differences you have noticed between Ukrainian culture and life back home in New Zealand?
I always say Ukraine is like New Zealand. It's a very beautiful country, but in New Zealand we have less drones. It's actually the similarity is, you know, in terms of it's a very beautiful country, a very large country, all sorts of landscapes really, right? You know, you drive through the Ukrainian countryside and you see all sorts of, you know, things. We have all sorts, you know, we have deserts, mountains, you know, hills, open fields. So that's very sort of you know, similarity. But of course, there are a lot of differences as well. The language is very different. Ukrainian is very different to English. Is that, for example? So yeah, a lot of similarities and a lot of differences. You certainly start to notice them. And I say it's a lot of little ones as well, sort of that build up. But you learn them as you integrate into the culture, right?
If the war does come to an end at some point, do you see yourself staying in Ukraine or would you look to come back home to New Zealand?
Oh, I intend to keep living and working in Ukraine, even, you know, after the war ends, you know, building a life here. And of course, I will come back to New Zealand, you know, come on a holiday, come see all the friends and, you know, people that I've been away from for many years. That'll be the first thing I do as soon as we win, get a plane ticket booked to come see everyone back home. But yeah, I do, in terms of long term, I'm going to be staying and living here in Ukraine.
Do you think you'll come back to visit New Zealand at some point, regardless of how things unfold, even just to see family?
Well, the thing is, with the war going on, right, it's a bit difficult, you know, to leave, especially in the military. You have to get special permission to leave and get outside the country. And also the Ukrainian Brothers in Arms I fight alongside, I always say, I'm not leaving until they do, right? I don't want to leave the, you know, country when I know that they're here, you know, still fighting, right? So for me, it's a moral and practical thing. After the war, yes, I'll have a lot of time to come visit. But until that point, yeah, I'm staying here in Ukraine.
On a lighter note, what is the food that you miss most from home?
Oh, it is a good question. I do miss my fish and chips and I do miss potato top pies. I underestimated just how big, you know, of a thing pies were back home. But here in Ukraine, they are very hard to come by. And I've not seen a single potato top pie yet in all my time. It's some true suffering right there. But yeah, so I do miss that.
And what is a local Ukrainian food you have come to genuinely enjoy since you have arrived?
Oh, borscht. Borscht is the absolute best food ever, other than potato top pies. It's very good with smetana as well, and actually I've learned how to make it during my time in Ukraine, because, you know, when we would be at the safe house chilling, my bros would always make borscht all the time. It's a pretty simple, pretty easy, and very cheap meal to cook up. You make a big pot of it, can last you a couple of days. So that is my favourite, red borscht especially. It's very yum. You know, you can dip a little bit of bread in it, of course, have the smetana. It tastes very homely, to be honest, in a way I can't describe, right? You know, there's nothing better than coming back from the front, get to the safe house, and you see one of the guys is cooking up a big pot of borscht, you know, have a nice warm spoonful of that.
Even in a conversation as serious as this one, Kiwi, I want to ask you a few of our unusual fun questions, because partly I think everyone deserves a moment of lightness, including you. So, what is the closest thing to magic you've ever seen or experienced?
Closest thing to magic? Oh, that is a great question. Oh, that's a good question, actually. I have to think about that. I suppose in a practical sense, closest thing to magic was when I was on a frontline infantry position and we had a friendly drone drop off some supplies for us. And one of the guys had packed in a, you know, like a thermos that was full of borscht. And in the time that from the, when the borscht had been made to delivered to us via the drone, the borscht was still warm. So we had a nice cup of that. That was quite magic for me, I would say, perhaps.
What is the grossest thing that you can think of?
Oh, you see quite a lot. You do see quite a lot here. I do have a bit of a dark story. Sometimes I have to laugh at it just because of how absurd it is. So one time during a reconnaissance mission, we were flying a Mavic drone because we were planning an assault on a Russian infantry position. And as we were overlooking this trench line, there were two Russian soldiers, right? And one of them gets hit by a Ukrainian FPV drone. Now, his squad mate survived. One of the guys was killed instantly on the spot, and he burst into flames. Now, his squad mate, instead of providing any sort of medical aid, pulled out a cigarette and on his burning mate's corpse, he lit up his cig. And I was watching this through the drone feed and I was just like, I could not believe what I was seeing. That was certainly quite gross. I would not want to, that is not something I would ever do. I can tell you that much. Yep, that was my look too.
SpongeBob or The Simpsons?
Oh, SpongeBob. No doubt.
If you could learn to do something new, what would it be?
Learn to do something new? Oh, I certainly learn to be completely fluent in Ukrainian. That one would be a very useful skill to have. And other than that, I would like to learn how to skydive fully. That will be something I want to do after the war.
What is your message to all the young people who want to make a difference but don't know where to start?
Well, a lot of it, it's beginning in sort of activism and getting involved in your local communities, right? Getting involved in local initiatives, building up your local community is a very big thing you can do, you know, to sort of help. And of course, for initiatives perhaps specific to Ukraine as well, there's a lot of organisations in New Zealand that fundraise for us that try to get us guys in the frontline equipment, things like that. So there's a great organisation that I've been chatting with called Mahi for Ukraine, and they're a very wonderful group that has been helping us and assisting.
If you could have one superpower right now, what would it be?
Oh, that would be easy. I would probably have it to be bulletproof. No doubt about that one.
If you could time travel, would you go forward or backwards?
I'd probably go backward. Go find which, hospital Putin was born in, and I won't go into any more detail other than that.
Before we finish, Kiwi, would you like to say something to our listeners in each of the languages that you speak? English, Ukrainian, and any other language you've picked up, and leave us with a message or a wish for everyone listening?
Ну так, я хочу дякувати до людей. I want to thank everyone for listening, for sort of taking in my story, for, being as engaged with Ukraine as everyone is, right? One of the main questions I get asked here, right, is from Ukrainians is, do people back home know about the war? And I always say, well, yes, people back home are very firmly on the side of supporting Ukraine, even if New Zealand geographically is very far away. So I just want to say we're grateful for every single bit of support that we get. And Slava Ukraine! Glory to Ukraine.
Kiwi, I do not think there is an adequate way to say thank you for a conversation like this one. You were a teenager in Wellington watching a war begin on the news, and today you are a 21-year-old serving on the front line on that same war in a uniform with a drone in your hands, halfway around the world from everything and everyone you grew up with. Whether any of us think about that war in the abstract, what is undeniable is the courage it takes to do what you have done and the responsibility you clearly feel toward people you did not grow up with but chose to stand beside anyway. To everyone listening, please stay safe, Kiwi, and please come home one day whenever that day comes to the country and the family that are still here, still proud of you and still hoping for your safe return. Thank you for trusting us with even a small part of your story today. Ka kite anō, everyone, and please keep this conversation in your thoughts. That's the show, everybody. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this show and want to hear more, head over to planes.org.nz for past episodes. You can also subscribe on Spotify and Apple Podcasts to get the new episodes delivered right to you. Do you have a talent you'd like to share? I'd love to talk to you. Just email info@planes.org.nz to get in touch. Keep working on your talents. You are amazing. Until next time, bye!